It's Wednesday, March 28th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 45 of Fear the Boot, the show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 59 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and on the mics today is Adam.
Hi, Dan.
Mike.
Hello.
John.
Hey.
And Chad.
Howdy.
And hello back to you, Adam. Chad, the Travesty Contest still in full swing, though it will be ending this coming week. So on Saturday, March 31st, noon Central Time, that is your deadline to get on our forums and give us a campaign setting in 500 words or less for the new World of Darkness setting, Chad the Travesty. We've actually got quite a few entries already, and some of them are really good.
A Vampire the Masquerade. You turn into a vampire, and Werewolf the Apocalypse, you turn into a werewolf, and Chad the Travesty, you turn into me.
See, that's the travesty. That's
we left it totally open-ended so that the listeners could decide what exactly happened in the world of Chad the Travesty, and there's several different angles, many of which are quite hilarious.
Right. See,
but
Chad,
the jury's still out.
So far, I can't answer your question. I don't know what happens in Chad the Travesty. We need the listeners out there to tell us what happens in Chad the Travesty. And this coming Saturday, we will pick a winner. That winner will get two things. One is they will get to pick any item they like out of the Fear the Boot store, and we will send it their way. The second thing is they can give us any one topic they want to hear about, and we'll talk about it, provided it's not offensive, political, whatever, the usual list of things we give. And if it's gaming related, it'll be in a regular episode. If it's wildly off kilter, it'll be a bonus episode. Last week, we talked about the Brownsburg Public Library Group. It's a D&D group that meets at a library in Indiana that is trying to get teenagers and new people involved in role-playing games. Yes, on drugs. Involved in
Nancy Reagan herself is leading the crusade.
Trying to get these people involved in role-playing games, and they're doing it through getting role-playing books stocked on the shelves of the library. And I wanted to do a quick re-hit on that because I got an email from Emily, who actually works at that library, who wanted to add some thoughts to that, sort of correct a few of the things that we had said and actually give another perspective on this whole thing.
Is she part of the group or is she just a library?
I believe she is part of the group. So she says, "Hi, guys. Thanks so much for the mention of our D&D program on your show. Keith has done great things with these teens. However, I'm sorry that you guys obviously haven't had much or very good contact with libraries. I promise, many librarians are cool. If you talk with them, most will be happy to buy the book you request. You shouldn't make your first offer a donation. As taxpayers, you are already paying for the items in the library, and you should have at least a way of suggesting items for them to stock. Also, many libraries, especially in larger cities, are beginning to hire staffs to work specifically with teens as I do. This is the person to partner with in getting a teen RPG group going. In fact, if you're interested, the adult librarians might do a program or a series of programs for an adult RPG audience. Really, all you have to do is ask." As she's saying, apparently with libraries nowadays, you can walk in, or maybe this has always been the case, since the age of the internet, I can't say I've really been much in public libraries, which is probably to my shame.
I haven't been in a public library since I stole one of their books when I was in high school.
Do they know about it?
They do
now. Whoa!
Well, when I say stole, I mean I checked out a book and then I didn't return it for 10 years.
So by stole, you do mean stole.
Stole, yeah, pretty much.
You just stole.
No, I'm not. This is more the details of the stealing rather than me excusing it. No, it was the complete annotated Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, okay.
It was really good because the little notes on the bottom talked about all the the political things that he was saying and what all the metaphors he was using. It was really neat.
All right. Well, the point being, if you guys are interested in trying to get an RPG group going at your library, or as we suggested in the last episode, are willing to try and get RPG books at least stocked in the reference or young adult section so that other people can pick them up and possibly start in on the hobby. Emily is telling us that this is apparently a little bit easier than we thought it was, and the library, actually, assuming they're reasonable people, should work with you to both buy the book and to help you get that group started. So we still recommend talking to the people because you just don't know who's employed there or how they're going to react to the idea of Dungeons & Dragons books. But nonetheless, this is at least probably worth following up on within your city.
I like this thought process because at first he said librarians, and then I started to zone out, and I was like, hot librarian. And then I walk in the door and the hot librarian has a second edition book and says, "Hey, we just bought this for you. Go ahead and check it out."
And you're like, at that point, I'm checking it out.
The fantasy is complete. Continue. Huh.
And then she's like, I got a squirrel suit in the back.
I have some acorns outside.
And my rates are only 10 cents a day.
Perfect.
All right, while we're on the subjects of Dungeons & Dragons, someone wrote in asking us to kick something around, which I think we were actually going to do, which is to kick around our thoughts on the various editions of Dungeons & Dragons. Because I have to say that while I like a lot of the changes they did in 3rd edition, and I've not played 3.5, so I can't comment on 3.5.
It's the same damn game.
Yeah, that's what I've been told. It's basically 3.0 with some tweaks. I like a lot of things they added in 3.0. 2nd edition still holds a very special place in my heart.
Well, we played it for a lot of years.
And it's beautiful and perfect, too.
I don't think it's just the nostalgia.
And you need a stat.
Well, we got used to
bars and lift gates.
We really resisted 3.0 when it came out at first, too, because we were so used to 2.
Well, it was also the factor of having to rebuy all the books we already own. But, I mean, that's the nature of editions with any game.
Yeah, what's a few hundred bucks?
what is a few hundred bucks?
They were actually cheap as crap when they first came out. I think WotC took a loss on them and sold them for only, like, $20 per.
I think the player's handbook was $20. You know, to sort of get you in, and then the others.
The PHB was 20.
I think you're wrong there. I think all of the cores were 20. We'll look it up. Well,
I don't have a 3rd edition within. I'm holding 2nd edition right here, and the 2nd edition player's handbook was $20.
I still love that cover art. It looks like his head is about to fly off into the ether. Because that helmet is going to start flapping away.
I did like the art in 2nd edition, even that. Helmet's a little silly on the
cover. The blue art? No.
No, not the blue art.
The other stuff is good. The oil paintings are
good. The color art, yeah. Like that
stuff. The oil paintings are good.
The Monsters Compendium had much better art than the Monster Manual, though, I think.
Well, yeah. That would be the most used book.
My favorite Monster Manual picture, though, was... I forget what it was, but it was like something that was totally invisible.
The Invisible Stalker.
Yeah, and it had a blank picture.
Yes,
picture.
There is an artist credited in that for nothing but the Invisible Stalker. It's awesome. It's hilarious.
The easiest $100 somebody ever made. And they felt clever in the process.
That thing was no pushover either. I think it had 8 or 10 hit dice. I mean,
and you couldn't see it.
No.
You know, in the 3rd edition Monster Manual, they changed it. They actually drew something for its picture. It was
completely lame.
And then, the thing they drew, you could totally see it, which is like, that's not invisible.
Well, didn't it have a dashed outline?
Yeah, no.
Not in 2nd edition, it didn't.
No, I mean 3rd edition.
Oh, 3rd, I don't know.
No, not since the 80s.
But with our actual topic of 3rd edition versus 2nd edition and whatever, I really like how they balanced out the classes better, with the feats especially for the warriors. Now a warrior can tango with a mage much more easily.
Well, you know, it's strange. First let me hit on 1st edition. I actually do own the 1st edition of D&D, and they were still trying out a lot of concepts. For those of you that have never seen it, like dwarf and elf were classes. They were not races. You did not have race and class. If you were an elf, you were basically a fighter mage. So that was part of the character you played. Now, with 2nd edition versus 3rd edition, I think the thing that I like about 2nd edition, strangely, is also the thing that I like about 3rd edition. In 2nd edition, the classes were not quite all parallel. You could level up faster in some classes than others. The class powers were not necessarily balanced, which is why some progressed faster in XP.
That's true.
And certainly at the higher end, the wizards had just about everything there was up on the warriors.
Oh, yeah. I don't think it took half of the experience for a rogue to hit 20 that it took for a wizard to.
Yeah, and in 3rd edition...
I'm sorry, a thief. Excuse my anachronism. Continue, Dan.
In 3rd edition, they did a lot to balance those classes out, put them on the same XP chart. Suddenly, clerics and wizards both get the stat-based spell bonuses, and you had the feats that balanced out the warriors, and they did a great job with it. But I almost think in bringing everyone on the same level that the game lost something feel-wise. And I don't think
the game has a feel. I mean, the different, like, modules and campaign settings and worlds you buy, definitely have, you know, Forgotten Realms, Ravenloft, that all has a feel. To me, Dungeons and Dragons has absolutely no feel except generic Middle Ages.
I largely agree with what you're saying. I see exactly where you're coming from.
Generic Middle Age heroic system.
I think rules absolutely can convey feel, and they do convey feel. I mean, when you have a rogue who has less powers than the wizard and is progressing faster and so on and so forth, you definitely get the sense that your character you're playing is an underdog. He's a character whose life is moving a lot faster, who's likely to burn out or be killed a lot faster.
See, and I guess that's why I don't like the system, because that redefines your character for you a little much. Now, of course, you can always go against the grain of that, but when the sort of leaning of the system is to lean your character that way, I don't know. I just don't think a game should do that.
So you're a bigger 3-0 guy.
I don't know. I've never even read the rules.
The debate is 2-0 to 3-0, and if you're against 2-0...
The debate is 2-0 to 3-0, and Chad's answer is the Chad game. The blank sheet of notebook paper.
Monostat. Well, I will say, though, we're talking like the wizard was really, really powerful. We didn't play with casting times.
No.
That does make him quite a bit more powerful.
Well, that's true, yeah. I think a lot of people, when they played second edition, kind of hedged around the casting times, probably did not use material components.
Hell no.
Yeah, and the spells could be interrupted, but in our games, not so much.
Right, yeah, which also did bring their power down significantly. You know, I think actually, really, my attachment to both 2-0 and 3-0 is emotional, that I want to play 2-0 because of the nostalgia. I want to play 3-0 because it's the most current. And I think, really, game-wise, I actually enjoy the two very similarly, and there's not really any substance to my decision of which one I pick up.
Well, and even though, like Ryan Dancy was explaining to us that 2.0 was releasing all these expansions because they didn't have anything else to do or whatever, but really it provided a lot of different, well, campaign settings for you to play 2.0 in. You don't have as many settings as you do in 3.0. You don't have as many in 3.0 as you did in 2.0, which I think takes away something from 3, because you don't have all of these rich settings that you could just pick up and start playing with. Not that they were all rich, but either way, it gives you fewer
Night
settings.
Oh, Night of the Comet, man. That was deep, deep setting right there.
I bought Al-Qaeda at Toys R Us.
Al-Qaeda.
I think it was only a letter or two off. The Arabian one was like Al-Qaedim or something like that.
Al-Qaedim, I think. I was actually wanted to play that one, but nobody was ever interested.
That was pretty stupid. You didn't miss anything.
looking back on it, I would tend to agree with you, but it was just something different at the time.
I'm sure Dan would love to see a Spelljammer come out for third edition, though.
Ooh.
If I can bring back my Lizard Man character, I would.
I want to play one of the hamsters.
Hamsters?
Yeah, the giant space hamsters.
Power the ship.
I wanted to play the pistol-wielding hippo men. Yes. We could have an entire Sesame Street team on a flying sailing ship flying through space.
Jim Henson's Dungeons and Dragons.
What a great idea for a campaign, and we'll call it Spelljammer. Ew.
Vomit-tastic.
Put that one right up on the shelf next to my copy of Shadowrun.
Here we go. Let's move on.
Something else that was different between second edition and third edition, this actually gets into the next topic we want to talk about, is third edition, the combat was written quite specifically, not only to encourage, but to require a play map.
Yeah, because they're selling models now.
Whereas, well...
You're so jaded.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, it's
not untrue.
Well, they're selling models. Not only are they selling models, it's not like you can say, well, my guys are going to go fight a whole bunch of skeletons tonight, so I need to stop by the hobby store and I need to pick up the pack of TSR D&D skeletons. Yeah, no big deal. You know, $5-$10, got them, we can go. No. You have to pick up a sealed pack, probably a case, and you don't know what models you're getting. And you have to go through all these cases until you find the ones that you need.
Are you sure you're not confusing D&D with Mage Knight?
No, D&D went to this model.
Did they really?
Yes, they did.
I'm not saying you're wrong, I just haven't seen this.
There's no click thing to it.
Right.
It is just the models you put on your battle map.
But you just buy, like, the monster pack, and you have no idea what...
You have no idea what it is.
And then there's time to say, guys, you're all Eldar tonight.
Yeah. Well, we just buy generic fantasy things.
You're an Eldar, you're a chess piece, and you are this cracker, don't eat it.
And the penny.
Well, we go for generic fantasy things. Where do we get those from, Danny?
Growl Partha.
Yeah, we've been getting all our stuff from, like, Reaper Minis, I think. Is run down to the hobby store and buy the generics for, like, $2 a pop.
Yeah.
For one thing, I don't like maps because they take away from some of the imagination and the setting component of the game. If you have a map sitting down where you've got things drawn out or whatever, I think it takes away a little bit from the creative element. But on the other hand, I like maps because in like our games that with one of our particular friends, we get spaces mixed up and we get screwed out of movement.
Yeah,
and
I will have to say I've been very frustrated in a couple games where every time I'm about to do an attack, the enemy is 5 feet and 1 inches away.
Yeah.
Every time they're about to do an attack, I'm 4 foot and 11 inches away.
And that's why maps are helpful.
Right, because maps are absolutely objective. You know where everybody is. There's no misinterpretations. If I said I'm running to the left of the pillar, there's no miscommunication about which pillar I mean. I think the problem, though, is, at least for me, I think they kind of drag down the game a little bit, because suddenly now, like you said, there's no imagination. You have this map represented right in front of you. And there's also, I think, at least me personally, I feel subconsciously compelled to want to be as accurate as I can be. If I'm sitting there, yeah, you can represent walls with plain blocks, and you can represent the skeleton you don't under model for with the chess piece. But over time, the map just gets, well, I mean, I guess even feeling silly aside, it gets hard to remember.
I think a good workaround is to just use the maps for combat. If you were using them for your actual dungeon or whatever, I think it takes away too much.
Well, I like maps for the accuracy aspect, although they introduce something that I really dislike to the table.
Slowness?
Distraction. Oh, because suddenly there's little figs, like Care Bears, or the little black thing, or perhaps little wires on the table that people who are doing anything can't possibly stop messing with during, oh, I don't know, maybe half an hour of sitting at a table. I'm talking to you.
Huh?
That's
that,
right.
That brings up an interesting question. You have a little charlatan with the Care Bears this evening. Who is this guy?
Hey, apparently he's a charlatan.
Ask questions, fiddle master.
Well, anybody keeping up with our Care Bear situation, whenever we go to this pizza place that's local, we buy Adam a Care Bear because they have one of those little bubble quarter machines. Well, lo and behold, we went there today. No Care Bears.
They have reconfigured their machine past 1989, and now the Care Bears are gone.
I should be sad, because my mom asked me the other day, what's up with these Care Bears?
Like, actually, they're back, because we have a four-year-old, and Care Bears are back.
Well, maybe we should go over to your house and steal some of your Care Bears.
Holy crap.
But I just mean they're not retro.
Do you have a quarter machine that gives them out?
No.
Yeah, it's a four-year-old. Here's a quarter, honey. Give me that.
That would work.
I never understood where the conflict came in the Care Bears world.
I'm happier than you are?
It's a massive pissing contest to be the happiest one, and it devolves into warfare? No, I don't see that
happening. No, actually,
there's a conflict.
Going way back to my childhood, I remember reading one Care Bear book where there was some guy that was covering the whole earth in concrete.
Cool.
That's awesome. Actually, to this day, I'm really not clear what the issue was.
You always find a place to park.
Our environment-friendly crew here.
Yeah, I'm not really clear what the issue was. So, the advice topic for today is actually the first in a series that we are going to do on how to run games in different genres. Just giving some kind of loose thoughts and best practices that we've observed over the years that goes along with running sci-fi games or fantasy games, steampunk games, cyberpunk games. And today we are going to take on what I think is the most difficult genre to run, which is a horror game.
Romance.
What's the difference?
Actually, Chad, you may have me on that one. I think a romance game may be harder to run than a horror game.
Group romance, no less.
Five dudes sitting around a table. Who's going to fall in love first?
Oh, and there's
roll to resist my manly charm. Roll your beard resistance. At level 6, I get a +2 to my beard resistance.
I have the feat of swarthy.
Oh my god, I have the vulnerability of attraction to your feet, Chad. We're in love.
who's that level?
Who's that beautiful little burly dame wearing Spanish fly?
Oh my.
Anyway, I think horror is difficult to run because of the fact that you have such a disconnect from the subject material. It's very hard to be afraid
of Chad.
Well, yeah, but that's assuming you're running Chad the Travesty. In other games...
Small children and animals are afraid of me.
That's not even legal in Missouri, so...
Yeah.
That completely derailed me.
You're welcome.
How many of you guys have attempted to run a horror game?
You know I have.
Not me.
I'm going to say two people at this table.
Chad? I have. Yeah.
You have?
I haven't successfully, too, yeah.
Successfully or unsuccessfully?
Successfully.
All right. What were some... Let's get to success in a moment. Let's talk about the difficulty.
Here at Fear the Boot, we are not concerned in any way with success.
You know what? Let's start off with horror games we've played where things have gone terribly, terribly awry.
I'm going to start off with the biggest problem that I've seen in horror games is the use of intimidation as a substitute for horror.
Here's a monster. Be afraid.
Yeah. You have 2 hit dice and a non-magical weapon. Here's all monsters that have 50 hit dice and can't be hit by your weapons. And that's not horror in and of itself.
What I've seen go awry is you introduce the monster and you're trying to set the mood of scary and horror, and then one ass player makes some comment about how your monster is actually a vamp cow, and then everybody at the table laughs. And then from that point on, your monster is always the vamp cow, mm-hmm. and you never break that mood breaker.
Yep.
Well, you had said something earlier about intimidation not working because you're talking about power levels. Generally, a level 5 creature is going to be very intimidating to a level 1 creature just because of power level. But as you pointed out before, you can't do anything against it. You're powerless to it. I would say if you're powerless in a different way, not an intimidation or scale of power, but in like the mystery element of, I don't know what this thing is. I don't know what it's vulnerable to. I don't know what it can do. That sort of thing can get you a little farther than just this guy's stronger than you.
I think intimidation has a role in creating horror. I mean, if you think about the simplest fears of a little child who's afraid of the boogeyman or the monster under the bed, part of that fear, even if it's not fully conscious, is this thing can do things to me, but I cannot harm it in return. And I think that, I mean, even look at like the horror movies. It's a whole lot easier for Freddy to kill you than it is for you to kill Freddy. And I think intimidation definitely plays some role in it, but it cannot be the main course. You cannot try and run a horror game where all you are bringing to the table is you're in a dark and creepy setting and everything out there is way beyond you in power level.
I agree with that.
You know, Adam, you and Mike both there kind of fired through a bunch of points I want to go back and hit in detail. Adam, you talked about you start to describe something and one of your players just starts making fun of it.
Yeah. And I think that is really important, is that a horror game success is not solely incumbent upon the skills of the GM. Everybody has to be on board.
Yeah, it is a huge team effort.
I mean, more so than just a normal game where, you know, it's like, okay, you're running D&D and everybody's heroes, you know, you have the Joker and you have the guy who's, you know, serious about the game, then you have your combat team, and it all kind of, you know.
That guy gets laughed out of the game, yeah, and the Jokers all start playing again.
Yeah, everything kind of gels, but I mean, when you have the guy who's cracking 1,000 jokes while you're trying to set this dark, evil mood, or you have you're trying to set a mood of horror and desperation and in the face of 1,000 zombies, and then you have the guy step up, it's like, I've got 2 machine guns, I can take them. You know, it's like you have to have a group of people who are willing
in the mood to play.
Well,
yeah. Horror.
Even
horror is a state of mind. Yeah. It's not something that you just arrive at.
Well, think about horror movies. When people really get the scare out of the horror movie, they came into this probably with the mindset that, to some degree, they wanted to be scared. They wanted to see a scary movie.
Assuming you're not talking about modern horror, which is just shock.
And
there's a difference.
I'm not talking about
scared.
Startled. Yeah. Being startled is not being afraid.
I hate modern horror movies because I hate being startled, but I love horror movies.
Well, and modern movies also have the slashers, where how much blood and guts can we show you in a screen?
Right. Think about some of these horror movies you've seen where you're with a bunch of guys or girls or whatever. They're just laughing at it, making fun of it, and pointing out the string that's holding up the monster or whatever.
Nah, and that's all good fun.
Yeah. Versus watching the same or similar movies by yourself at home with most of the lights turned off. This is a completely different experience because you don't have anyone trying to tear down that experience.
There was a video game that Arm, Axe, and I were playing a couple years ago. It was that GameCube game, the horror one.
Eternal Darkness.
Eternal Darkness. And it's a really, really scary game. You know, I can go on. I think I've gone into it before of all the weird stuff that you can do in it. But Arm and I were sitting there. We were in our apartment. It was the middle of the night. It was just the two of us. All the lights in the place were out. And we were there, and we were really getting into this game. And it was so spooky. And we were really getting into the horror, and we were both playing it. And then Dawn walks in the door, throws the door open. Hey, guys, how's it going? Turns on all the lights, starts talking about her day at work. And we're just like, go away.
You know,
that was great.
Quickly doing an aside here, we talk about video games and movies, and of course, one of the difficulties with a tabletop role-playing game, you have none of the imagery. Everything that you have to work with is not image-based, it's speech-based. I don't want to get into that just yet, because Mike, I want to back up to something you said, which is you talked about the mystery of a monster being part of its horror, And one of the suggestions I would give is in a horror game, unless you're using archetypical monsters like vampires or skeletons, put your monster's manual away. Because if you describe a monster...
And I can flip the Arakocra.
And suddenly everyone's like, oh, that's a beholder. You have just lost... You know, you've just lost that kind of...
Yeah, there's no mystery.
Well, yeah, there's no mystery, and suddenly people just go into this mechanical mode of, oh, this is a such and such. All I need to do is use fire, and it'll die. And
well, it has 6 hit dice. Yeah. You can probably do 6 hit dice where the damage
right, exactly.
kills one of us.
And this is why I would heavily recommend, especially if we're talking D&D, if you are going to run a horror game, for heaven's sake, either use the archetypical monsters like skeletons that really don't matter, or make your own stuff up. Don't be referencing the monster's manual at all. Just
for
forget
ease of,
about it.
Ease of play, if you don't want to make your own stuff up, find a monster whose stats are in line with what you want to do, and just use the stats. You can call it whatever you want.
Or change the description, yeah.
Turn the lights down low so they can't read the book.
Yeah. I mean, come to think of it, a regular old dude with a beholder's freaky abilities would be significantly more scary than a beholder. Yawn.
Mm-hmm. Which games do you guys think work well for horror?
Well, let's just toss Cthulhu onto the table right now. And then let's move past that.
There was a sort of a debate that we had, Adam, before this. Zombie games like All Flesh Must Be Eaten and a couple of the others. Is that really a horror game?
I see those more as survivalist games because...
You're not afraid of... I mean, you're afraid of the zombies in the sense they can kill you.
But, and there's so many of them that you can't kill enough of them.
But that's the same type of way you'd be afraid of, like, a street gang.
Yeah.
Or be afraid of the communists.
That's not the
kind of fear that you're going...
It's one of the chief elements
really
of the mystery.
Too. Mm-hmm. Like, All Flesh is very tongue-in-cheek.
I don't think so.
All Flesh offers a variety of scenarios that you can run, and some of them are campy and tongue-in-cheek, and some of the ones that we've run are campy and tongue-in-cheek.
Well, yeah,
but
my
then
only
there
experience
are, like,
has
really,
been with you guys, so if that's all we've done, then...
And there is a comedy element to the game. You know, you can play the cheerleader, and you can play the football player.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The Lord is my point man, I shall not want.
That's
funny, but it's not scary.
Cool. Yeah.
I think another good idea might be changing the danger element of the game, because as player characters, if my character dies, oh no, I have to roll up a new one, which does kind of suck, but how much worse if you're stuck playing the character and something terrible has happened to him? If, you know, he gets deformed or you lose limbs or something like that, I think that
That's
could...
That's Cthulhu's whole thing, is that you get turned insane.
Yeah, and I think that could add a little bit more of a danger element to the games, because it's so hard to get that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
How do you guys feel about changing the physical environment of the game? Not in the game, but like in the room. Lighting candles, putting on scary music.
Only if you do it a little bit. Too much is not a good thing.
It depends on your group. I mean, like we said earlier, your group has to be with you in this. It has to be into it with you. And I think the more they are into it with you, the more of that stuff that you can use. Whereas if they're kind of where it's like, okay, we want to run it, and we're not going to crack jokes and stuff, but we still kind of want a normal game, and you come out in a cloak, and you've got the eerie music and the fags, and you're holding 2 candles in your hand going, ooh, yeah, so you're going to get that.
Chad, just the image of you doing that. It's brought me to near tears.
You know, it's subtlety.
But some groups are into
subtlety, that. Subtlety, because you've got to think this. I just said a moment ago that you have no imagery to work with in a role-playing game. And actually, I'm wrong, because, Chad, you're right, that the way you choose to present the gaming environment in that regard is very much a move of image. And your players, while they cannot see the setting, cannot see the characters, they can very well see you and see each other. And if you find some way to set the environment right, do subtle little things like turn the lights down a little bit or something, like, I don't even know, it depends on the group, depends on your taste, that could add a lot to the game. But yeah, it's just like a movie. If you just come out with this ridiculous setup, just like people laugh at in a movie, people are going to be laughing at the game. They're not going to be frightened. They're just going to be like snickering or trying not to laugh, depending on how polite they are.
You turn the lights down and you have players who are bitching that it's too dark in the room. Maybe turning the lights down isn't going to really help your setup.
Yeah,
you know,
if you can't see the character sheet anymore.
Yeah, and if you turn the lights down and put the candles on and you know, Barry White jumps onto the CD box, they're going to get a different idea. It's not going to be scary.
Who's touching
well,
me?
Well, it might be.
It might be scary.
Roll to touch me.
You know, so where are the other players? Why did you tell them to go home?
Well,
I had another idea sitting here, too. I think if you could find out, if you know your players well, if you know what scares the players in real life, like if Dan's scared to death of spiders, and I have spiders crawling all over the character, I think using what you know of your players could help some, too.
I think it's some real spiders.
There you go.
This would certainly be an entertaining game.
I'm afraid
game.
Of getting shot, so Dan shoots me.
Something I think is underrepresented within horror role-playing games, and it's not actually as underrepresented in movies, is science fiction. The use of a sci-fi setting in horror.
Yeah. You're saying that about movies. I think that horror is overrepresented in sci-fi movies.
I agree.
That's the problem with sci-fi movies. You can't get a good just aliens and spaceships and political intrigue. It has to be something that scares you.
Yeah. But within role-playing games, you see a lot of fantasy horror and probably even more modern or semi-modern horror. But you don't really see much in terms of sci-fi. And I don't know that necessarily I've run any sci-fi horror games specifically, but I have tried to run a lot of sci-fi suspense or sci-fi kind of mind trip or psychological thriller sort of stories, and it's actually, for me, worked out very well.
Yeah, that's weird, because when I run fantasy, I tend to run horror and political intrigue and mind trip sort of reversals and stuff. But when I run sci-fi, for some reason, I just tend to run
action.
Jaunty space adventures with swashbuckling players.
You know what's funny is I'm the exact reverse.
Yeah,
my fantasy games tend to be more adventurous, while my sci-fi games tend to be much more dark and brooding.
Which is probably why I like your sci-fi games so well, as opposed to fantasy games in
general. The Clanners scare me.
All my stuff is just jaunty swashbuckling with Errol Flynn music going on in the background all the time. Punctuated by the Benny Hill theme.
I was so intrigued by the thought of Errol Flynn having his own band that I never got to Benny Hill. You know, it's not exactly advice, but I think one of the things that really has to play into this is personal charisma. Are you a good enough storyteller to really get and keep people's attention?
No.
Putting
it on the table.
You got to know your limits. I mean, there's got to be some point you look in the mirror and say, you know what? I'm just really not cut out for beauty competition. Or,
hey, what are you saying, jerk?
I'm saying you're an ugly son of a bitch.
Now, all right. Well, as long as we're all clear on that point.
But I think the same thing in gaming. You just got to know your limits. You've got to be honest with yourself about what you are and are not good at. And if you just don't have the ability to tell a story that would grab people's attention like this, to set scenes, to just get people to buy into where you're at, then probably horror games are not for you. And as much as you like them, maybe it's just time to admit that you're better off doing something that's more adventurous or more.
But if you're a dark, creepy, scary person that everyone's kind of intimidated by, maybe horror games are for you.
Yeah, maybe it's time to stop running the glowing little fairy adventures and move over to horror. Chad, what are some of the things that you say you've run successful horror games, and I believe I have too? What are some of the things that have helped you successfully create that kind of fear?
Quality.
Vague.
Quality over quantity. Instead of having tons and tons of monsters.
Talk about vague. Hang on.
Okay.
Let's talk about vague.
Well, it's a Hitchcockian thing. You know, you don't. What's the exact wording of Hitchcock's quote? You don't show the monster, you let the audience imagine it in their mind.
Yeah, I mean,
something like.
The idea with Hitchcock's movie making was that he accepted that he could not know what the worst conjurings of your mind were, and therefore he would simply imply these things and let you scare yourself. That whatever monster, whatever moment of violence, anything you want to think about, it was better for him just to show shadows and lights and let you invent in your own mind what was there, rather than him showing you something that would probably fall short of your worst imaginings.
My idea with horror and that sort of thing is that a player's imagination is going to be so much better than my descriptions. So in my descriptions, I just give a couple of little hooks. I plant little seeds for the player so that their imagination can take hold of it and expand on it.
I realize this is very on the spot, but can you give an example? I know it may not be your best quality because it's just on the spot. You haven't had time to think about this or
Yeah. In our Seasons game, I had Ash fall from the sky, and I just described it. I described it, as snow and its powdery substance, and it blotted out the sun, and it did this, and it was just this ash falling everywhere. But I never explained why it was there. I never explained where it came from. The players, being superstitious Middle Ages nobles, assumed it was something supernatural.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction there. Vague in the reasons why things are, but not vague in the descriptions therein of those actions.
Yeah, example that I could come up with from some of my games is have them in a dark room. Like, for whatever reason, the room's out of their control. They've been locked in here. They fell in here. The power's gone out on the ship, whatever the case is. And all of a sudden, there will be a voice in there talking with them and saying usually these very unusual things. And not, like, just whispering at them. Actually conversing with them, just implying all kinds of strange things. And they never see who they're talking to. They have no idea who or what is in the room with them. There's just something about 6 to 10 feet away that's just came there out of nowhere and is talking to them about nothing in particular and then disappears. And it's a complete implication.
I converse with the darkness.
It's a complete implication. You have no idea, because if I told you all of a sudden, okay, you turn on the lights and it's a guy in an alabaster mask, you can suddenly, Adam raises eyebrows, and that's the point, that this is never going to measure up to this unknown, numinous horror you conjured up in your mind ahead of time. All right, so Chad, other than vagueness, what else? You mentioned, I think, variety was your next one?
No, quality over quantity.
Quality over quantity.
Yeah, instead of just layering it on, let me put you this way. One zombie is far more scary than 10,000 zombies. 10,000 zombies is just a force of nature.
They lose their significance.
Yeah, it's just this wave, whereas you have one zombie and you lay a lot of description on it and you let the players, kind of take that into their mind.
When you describe the zombie, scary. Use the word "icker" at every opportunity.
I can think of this even from a standpoint of video games, like horror first-person shooters. The first time you encounter this big, hideous, whatever beast, you're like, holy crap, and you're trying to back around the corner. Mm-hmm. But by the time you've seen your 100th, you're like, oh, it's one of these, and you've probably come up with your own nickname for them. And
even not the big, hideous horror beast, just the standard zombie, the first one you march across in Resident Evil that's eaten that guy's face in, 5 minutes into the game, it's scary. I mean, 10 minutes later, you've killed 50 of them, but they present it as a shock.
Also, you don't tell the players what's going on. And that's on a sort of larger level and on a smaller level, too. You make the players unsure of everything. You don't lie to the players, you don't trick the players, but you leave out lots of information. There's very little exposition.
I'm getting an example as we're sitting here talking, but in the movie Donnie Darko, which is, I realized, evokes weird emotional things and whatnot, but they have
it's
this
a very good movie.
It is a good movie, but they have this psychotic bunny ordering this guy around, and for the longest time, you don't know what the heck this is going. Why is this psychotic bunny ordering him around? But at the end, you find out this is the guy.
Doing the movie
tell
for someone?
People?
I haven't even seen it.
Well, okay. At the end, you find out why he's seeing the psychotic bunny. But I think that's kind of what you're getting at, is that these weird things keep occurring, and you don't know why. But then later on, at the end, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But throughout the whole movie, it was kind of this weird, creepy kind of thing.
I will absolutely back what they're saying. Mystery is a huge part of this, that the less people understand, we talked about how we imply things rather than show them, but just along those lines, the less people understand about the setting, the less they understand about the plot, this is going to help you. Now, there's a point of extreme with this, where suddenly everything becomes so disjointed, so senseless, so meaningless, so uncontexted. You're just throwing random crap at them in this rapid barrage that, just like that 10,000th zombie, the mystery suddenly loses significance as well, and people just start shrugging their shoulders and saying, I can't follow any of this. This makes no sense at all.
But something I would add in order to make it good, to further my example that I was using a minute ago, over the course of the movie, you're gradually finding more and more out, just little pieces that don't really mean anything, but towards the end, you could almost guess what the bunny was. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Because they kept feeding you these little pieces that didn't make any sense in of themselves, but if you put them all together, kind of like in The Sixth Sense, Bruce Willis, you get these...
Oh, come on!
You just ruined another movie!
Oh, come on, everybody's seen it.
No! Oh.
That's getting cut out. Dude!
What?
Spoilers!
Oh, okay. Well, Mr. Snape kills Dumbledore, you got no high ground on me.
Yeah, but that was funny. This is 2,000 people are going to be pissed at you.
Okay, fine. In The Sixth Sense, we get several clues throughout the whole course of the movie, and at the end, you could almost guess what happened. But each of these clues in of themselves don't necessarily tell you anything. And I think in order to do a horror thing well, a mystery thing rather well, that's what you have to do is give them little pieces as time goes on.
But you know, with those examples you just gave, one of the things that I would point out, kind of backing up a little bit to the point, is there was a single mystery or maybe a small number of mysteries that you weren't, we were never just being bombarded with random imagery with this nonsensical parade of things. There was always a small number of mysteries that were slowly being unfolded. Actually, one of the things I wrote on the big board is there is a difference, just as we talked about, there's a difference between intimidation and horror. There is also a difference between horror and frustration. That if you have a plot where the players can never figure anything out, can never get any closer to the truth, can never accomplish, beat, defeat, win anything, similarly, you've not created horror, you've just created annoyance. And eventually, even if you've got their attention originally, that emotion of annoyance will overpower that emotion of horror.
Absolutely.
You know what? Thinking back to the successful horror game I played in, one of the things that really unsettled me as a player was there was a strong NPC whose motivations I could not discern.
That's a good point.
That was something that really unedged me. Like, there were, he would do things that appeared on the surface to be in kind, however...
You know, that's a, I don't know the context of this NPC, but this kind of just kicks something into my mind. When we talk about horror, obviously, we talk a lot about the setting of the game, and we talk a lot about the monsters or the adversaries or the mystery of the game.
Yeah, sometimes
but
the
your
mystery
friends,
isn't, yes.
Your friends can be just as scary as your
sometimes
enemies.
Sometimes their
are.
Motivations and their actions can be worse than what you
yeah.
what you don't
yeah.
know. Like, the evil you know is worse than the evil you don't know.
Yeah, it was great, this NPC, without getting too much into a gaming store here, this NPC was going around and helping each of the players in different ways. But the ways I had him helping the players were hurting other players, and he was playing this game. And they all the players knew, the characters didn't, and the players and the characters both didn't know what this guy's motivation was. And it wasn't just some random thing. I wasn't doing random things. I actually had in my mind the whole why this guy was here, what he was doing, his reasons for doing them. And that's important when you have something like that, so that his actions that the players see and don't understand are consistent.
Yeah, consistency is a big one.
Yeah, and because that's really scary, because then the players are like, this guy is up to something. Instead of the players saying, well, this NPC is just screwing with us, they're like, he is doing something,
yeah,
and we don't know what it is.
More, is a lot worse than him just messing with me, because then
yeah.
I can deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Because people are jerks, and you just walk away from
yeah,
jerks.
Yeah, people are asses. I can deal with it.
Yeah.
Something else you got to look at is your real-life environment. Distractions don't help.
No.
If you are playing in a house that has three kids running around upstairs, and somebody constantly ringing the doorbell, and a bird tweeting in a cage, it's real hard to get scared about anything. Because you always have something bringing you back to reality. Like, Chad, you were talking about Dawn coming in, flipping on the lights in the middle of your video game. It's the same thing. If you've got these distractions, it's just going to pull you out of the game. And if that's your environment, I mean, that's cool. I realize people grow up and get families and all that kind of stuff. It may just be best to accept that either you need to run these games at late night, or maybe horror is not for you.
Well, and just like in a movie theater, turn your cell phones off.
Yeah,
it's the same way. It pulls you out of the movie.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, whether you're running a horror game or a power game, it doesn't matter. That's an etiquette thing, too. That was one thing that helped in our horror game, was that it was in my apartment, which is very tiny and small and too small to run a game in.
And too hot.
Too hot? Because it was a million degrees in there.
No, it is burning like the surface of the sun.
I'd say it's at least 3/4 pot pie in there.
But the gaming environment there was very close. Everyone was sitting very close. It was very intimate.
We could all smell each other.
Yeah, in some cases, yeah.
Yes,
I could even think, Chad, back when you and I, for a while there, one of our friends, his grandfather, unfortunately, got taken to a home. And so we took over his house, cleaned it up, and for a while we
There's some funny stories about that,
too. Yeah, there's some funny stories about this. This would be a good bonus episode. But for a while, we were gaming in there. And since we had, I mean, here we were, three guys, college age, well, several of us, the particular story, there's three of us. But here we are, a bunch of guys, all college age, in this house, completely alone, no phone hooked up. There was nobody else in there, nothing else going on. It was kind of isolated. It's down.
That house was creepy on its own.
Yeah, I mean, it was creepy. It's down a back road to begin with. And then it's off a ways a little bit from this road. And I remember we had some games where we would sit in there and we had these gigantic candles and we'd light them and we'd start running these games. And we never even intended for them to be horror games.
Yeah, but they became creepy.
But we'd get partway through and, man, it's like we just had to stop and walk away for a second because it was getting too weird. But we didn't even attempt to.
That kind of brings up another question for me because you said that they weren't intended to be horror games. Can you have a horror game with nothing supernatural in it?
Yes.
Yes.
And that isn't about A, serial killers, or B, sci-fi aliens?
Yes.
Yes. Well, how? I'm going to amend B. Okay, so picture this. You have this whole consistent setting, and then from out of nowhere, these super-powered people show up and start killing everybody, and they're unstoppable. Oh, wait, I'm talking about Battletech.
I would say you'd have to do it in an unusual and in a psychological way. If you turned your players against, you know, like it's a terrible thing to turn players against each other.
But if you did it in the right sort of way,
like for example, oh, I don't want to spoil a campaign that I'm writing, but there are...
Wow, you've almost spoiled two movies.
Those are already out.
I think you can.
Well, I think you can because of the fact that, first of all, you can create still that sense of the unknown. That if you, let's say, you play a game where the two or three guys, the players, let's say something stupid, like they're all in an office building. One of them's an office worker staying late. One's the night janitor. The other's the night security guard. The building, let's say it's like, I don't know, a bank or a government institution where if the power gets cut, you can't get out. There's locks that require a power to operate.
There's some Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah, some god by machine here where you just can't get out. And all of a sudden, everything shuts off and they're stuck in this building and there's just people creeping around and
do sort of like a conspiracy
thing. Yeah, it's a conspiracy thing. And, you know, you could go the whole plot without a single person dying, and I think you could still create that kind of fear just because the environment is scary, you have that element of unknown. Assuming you can get things right around the table, if you can get that synergy where everyone wants to be scared and is playing into that, and you don't have a wife or something running around the house while you're doing this, breaking the mood, then I think you absolutely could get something that does not involve murder, does not involve supernatural, does not involve space aliens. Yeah.
The thing I notice that we keep coming back to, and I think is the single most important thing to running a horror game, a scary horror game, is that everybody has to be on board with it. Every single player in your group and the GM has to be willing to be scared, to accept the horror aspect of it, and to play, not you know, sort of sell out to the GM and just do whatever the GM says, but more...
They got
to
play along.
They got to play along with it, yeah. I mean, you got to keep the joking down to a minimum. You got to keep certain other behaviors down to a minimum, and you have to accept
don't
certain throw weaknesses.
Cheetos.
Yeah.
Don't make fun of the monsters. I mean, play along with it.
Monsters come out, it has all kind of tentacles and fangs, no hentai jokes.
Yeah, if you want to defeat the horror element, you can. I mean, just accept that. If you want to deflate the whole thing with jokes,
you will do it.
You'll get it done. Yeah. Everyone has to agree.
And it'll
not
be really funny and everyone will laugh, and then that's the end of the campaign and you start a new one.
Yeah.
I gotta say, and I think I said this at the start, and I've gotta repeat this again, horror is the hardest thing to run.
Other than romance.
Well, different reasons, but I think you've just got to accept that as you go into this, if the group is wrong, if the environment is wrong, if the situation's wrong, if people just came out of work and they just want to play around and blow off steam, man, you just may have to accept that this just isn't going to work. You know, not everyone out there is cut out to be a professional singer, and not every group out there is going to be able to run a horror game. And I'll say right now that I have not run many horror games for this exact reason. It is so hard to do.
I think I've run two games that I specifically wanted to be horror, and the feedback I got on them was really positive. So,
oh, they're great when they work. Mm-hmm. They are
the, one was with you.
Yeah, you walk away with so much emotion, so much thought. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the type of thing. I think the best games in the world are those where when people walk away, they're still thinking and talking about them.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord, I can already feel the discussion on the way home because I rode up with Chad and John, which is going to be the season's game rehash.
For the thousandth time.
Yeah.
I absolutely love horror games. They're probably my favorite. So, yeah, I'm with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, strangely, the settings, some of the settings that were intended to be horror, I don't think worked that well for it.
Like right. World of Darkness?
World of Darkness,
I don't consider World of Darkness a horror game.
I don't think it is a horror game, and here's why. I think you could run a horror game in it, just like I think you could run a horror game in anything.
Yeah.
But why be afraid of the monster in the closet when you're the monster in the closet?
Right.
If you're playing vampire, where you're playing
or a werewolf,
or a ranger,
or a travesty,
or Chad.
If you're playing a hunter or a human, though, it could be.
Well, that's true, but once again, I think the game really, while they made it possible to play humans, and there was my favorite Hunter's Hunted expansion, I don't think they have ever made any serious attempt to make humans the focus of the game. I mean, all the books.
Human, the mundanity.
Yeah, there's no...
There's, you don't know what's going on, nor do you care.
There's no human, the cab driver. It's, you know, yeah, you can play humans, and I'm sure people have run great games playing humans. We've had, well, actually, we never have had a good Hunter's Hunted game, but We've tried several. No, they could be good, but it's, you know, the game is intended that you're playing a vampire or a changeling or a werewolf or a mage.
Well, I disagree, actually, because now I haven't read the whole book yet for World of Darkness, but I'll tell you, the fluff parts in the very beginning of the book make some great arguments for how regular humans could possibly play interesting games in World of Darkness.
Well, and of course, this may have changed.
Yeah.
This may have changed, of course, in For example,
in the fluff, there is a story of a journalist who is hired to tell the story of a particular old man.
That's, so, that's
Interview with a Vampire.
Okay, cut that part. No. It's not Interview with the Vampire because it's not a vampire.
The old man's not a vampire?
Oh. No.
Is he telling his vampire story?
No.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
Oh, well, all
okay,
right.
Okay, so carry on. Maybe this is pretty cool.
Is Interview with the Werewolf?
Like, yeah. Okay, cut that. I look
you
stupid.
You know what? For some strange reason, ages. Old people and little kids are scary.
Yeah. They are.
I don't even know why that is, but for some reason, old people and little kids are scary.
Not in my games, because I have this thing. I really like old people, and I really respect the older generation a whole lot. I think it's a lot because I like stories, and I like storytellers.
I do, too.
And so they tell stories. So all of the old people I portray in my games are very old and rambunctious or surly, or none of them are scary. All of them are generally likable, or at least I try and make them likable, but that's just me. But yeah, no, I totally see what you're saying. When you show those sort of extremes, like you can have horror too. You can have horror of extreme beauty.
You know, you also really have scary horror that comes from things being out of place.
Yeah.
Like the child's doll that talks to you and tries to kill people. And I don't mean like the cheesy.
Chucky.
Yeah, I'll say I don't mean Chucky. I mean something more like just like a porcelain doll that just sits there and yeah. looks
Dead
at
silence.
You. Just sits there and looks at you. And every time you turn around, it's moved.
Yeah.
That kind of, I mean, that's freaky because it's so out of place. Something that's so innocent and so harmless is suddenly so intimidating.
Yeah, that I think that falls into subtlety. That's one of those subtlety things and the vague thing. You don't know why it's doing it. It's only doing it a little bit. You're not even sure that it is doing anything.
That's one of the reasons that horror, I think, is so hard to do, is that everything has to be in such measured doses.
Yeah.
You also got to know how to read your players, because let's say you're doing the porcelain doll thing, where they turn around and keep moving. If a game or two into it, the guy like walks back in the room and says, okay, I assume the porcelain doll's moved again, the answer is no. Even if the answer was yes, the answer is now no.
Yeah,
because they've come to expect it. It's stopped being scary.
Oh, I had that in our in the Seasons game that we're talking about, where
for anyone who's trying to figure out what Seasons is, it's the title they gave to a D&D generic game that Chad ran. There's no game system out there you've never heard of before called Seasons.
Yeah.
Please continue.
It wasn't even D&D. It was reinvented D&D. The wheel. Was it D&D?
It was reinvented the wheel.
No. Yeah, it was
D&D. It was that we reinvented the wheel.
Chad and D. But
okay, whatever.
C&D.
Chad, what's your story?
All right, go on.
Yeah, like my players would come to me and they at one point, and I had the whole game sort of planned out in my mind. I knew exactly where I wanted to go with. I knew how I wanted it to end. And then they're sitting around, and I hear them talking between each other at like a break, you know, soda break or whatever. And they're like, you know what I think is going to happen? Oh, yeah? What? I think that A, B, and C is going to happen for X, Y, and Z reasons, which was exactly what I had planned out. I'm like, oh, my God, no. They figured it out.
They figured it out too quickly.
Everything changed from that point on. And that's the good thing about being an improv GM is that I changed everything.
Well,
man, from
even
that point.
A non-improv game. I mean,
oh yeah, you've got to stop and rewrite your notes.
That's when you go back to your room
then.
And tear the maps down off your wall.
Yeah. Said, well, even as a non-improv GM, I've always preached having the ability to move the game quickly, and that's definitely one of those situations where you got to rethink what you've got. Don't have your notes so locked down you can't. But that's a different podcast we already did and may go back to someday, but aren't doing right now. Anything else on horror?
I like it. We need to do more.
Agreed. It's awesome.
Does a certain setting lend itself, and I mean very broad, say, I don't mean like Rifts or Shadowrun or whatever, I mean more like, does steampunk lend itself to horror? Does Wild West lend itself to horror? Does high fantasy,
I don't like, horror in my sci-fi.
I think...
Really? Me neither. I hate it in my sci-fi.
I love it.
I think it's easier to do in modern.
I think fantasy is harder to do it in.
I agree.
Particularly in D&D. Because of the fact that, number one, you've already accepted there are strange things in the world.
Yep.
The fact that something strange has happened is neither unexpected nor mysterious. It's just the way the world ticks. And secondly, everything, you're so familiar with it, you know your six-hit die dude can take that one-hit-die skeleton. And even if you find out partway through the battle you can't, you've already jumped it. You were unafraid of it when it showed up because you thought you could take it.
I'd take the opposite angle with that. With a sci-fi game, I accept that there's technology that I don't understand, so it is not that far of a jump to say, okay, well, if I don't understand the stuff about me personally,
right,
the thing that just walked out the door that, well, looks weird to me personally.
Well, see, but I'd take this, assuming you're not, okay, you talk about the monster scary sort of sci-fi, I agree with you, but I think if you do, like we were talking earlier, like the government conspiracy sort of thing within sci-fi, I think it can work wonderfully. I think part of it is you have to have your setting developed enough that people understand what is out of the ordinary.
Yeah,
that
I agree.
If you're in a sci-fi setting, and yeah, like you said, this big ugly monster walks up who can pass through walls, you just shrug your shoulders and say, well, it's a powerful alien with a technological device. And even if the truth later turns out to be it was actually a scientist who's like passing between dimensions, which is a lot more scary, it doesn't matter. I mean, unless you've developed the setting to the point that you've already said there are no aliens anywhere, period. Then you see this thing. Now all of a sudden you know, wait a minute, something's really wrong here. And it's the same thing in a fantasy setting. If there's a skeleton in the graveyard, this is just typical and an opportunity for a level grind.
Yeah.
The undead walking is never typical under any circumstances.
Modern settings work better.
Yeah. That's what I did with the fantasy game, with the Seasons game, is that I laid out to them that this was a sort of pseudo-Europe, and that it was a very low fantasy game, and the dead do not rise.
Real Europe.
Bavaria. Yeah, it was.
Okay.
And it, you know, the dead do not rise, and all this sort of stuff, but everybody is extremely superstitious. There's no magic. Everyone believes that there is magic. And then I broke rules. I broke rules that I set, and I had the dead rise, and I had some magic into it. I didn't do it too heavy, and I didn't do it to screw over the players, except unless you count like countless undead attacking the players as screwing them over, which I guess you could, but...
Yeah, or ghosts. Whispers of the demonic showing up in the priest's ear.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was a lot of fun.
I have nothing more on horror.
All right, then I think we're going to go ahead and sign this one out. Thank you guys for listening, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to fearthebooth.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at fearthebooth.com.